Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm speaking with Vlad Solomon, author of the book State Surveillance, Political Policing, and Counterterrorism in Britain, 1880 to 1914. Vlad, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Mark. Glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Sure. I'm based in Montreal. I'm independent historian of the 19th century, basically. I particularly interested in political history and cultural history and how the two are intertwined. I'm generally looking at English, British, rather, and French history.
There's an interesting crossover in your book that you'll probably illuminate as we get into it further, because as you describe in the book, what you're talking about is not just a English or British centric one, but one that has these definite pan-European linkages. What was it that led you to write a book about political policing in Britain during the late Victorian and Edwardian eras?
The book essentially grew out of my doctoral dissertation. Prior to that, I was looking into the anarchist movement in the United Kingdom in the late 19th century. And so that led me to kind of the other side of the coin, to ask myself how the authorities perceived and understood these radicals, not just how they understood themselves. And I realized that the only substantial contributions on the history of political policing in Britain had been in the kind of the late 70s and mid 1980s. And there was this kind of fresh batch of recently declassified archival documents at the National Archives at Kew that was just kind of sitting there and waiting to be explored. And so I thought I'd take that topic on and pursue it.
It's an interesting topic to pursue because you're not just illuminating the topic for us today, but you're also addressing this conception or belief that the British had about themselves. And you reflected very nicely with that quote from Charles Dickens, this idea that, yes, you have police in Britain in the Victorian era, but they're concerned with common crimes. And there's this belief that the British have that they don't need the sort of political policing that you see in places like, say, France and Italy and Russia. I was wondering if you could perhaps start us off by explaining exactly what distinguishes the type of policing that you focused on, and maybe tell us a little bit about the history of it in Britain prior to the period that you cover in your book.
Sure. In terms of what distinguishes it, I think political policing in the British Isles has, until the 20th century, pretty much was never very systematic. It was always more or less reactive in terms of the various subversive radical movements that were active at that period in time. So in in the early 19th century. There were these radical movements inspired by the French Revolution that were trying to organize in Britain, and some had revolutionary ambitions. Some were connected to Irish nationalism and the desire for Irish statehood. And so the structures that we see emerging in terms of political policing are in response to that, and being set up on a temporary basis with the understanding that once the danger passes, we can just sort of resume our former way of doing things and not be so aggressive and proactive. That is kind of not necessarily unique to Britain, but it's somewhat different from what was happening on the continent in places like France and the German-speaking states, where more or less permanent police structures that were specifically aimed at tackling radicalism were set up, and they continued throughout the 19th century and, of course, into the 20th. So I think it's this idea that a political policing is an exceptional thing. It's somewhat embarrassing. It's somewhat hard to control. It shouldn't be made permanent. But this is largely kind of a myth, as I grew to understand by looking at the sources, in that political policing had been in the British Isles since, really almost times immemorial, you could say, but definitely documented since at least the early modern period. Of course, there are references to spies and intelligence gathering in Shakespeare and during the Stuart monarchy, spies were routinely used to kind of keep the lid on the various conspiracies that were happening at the time, whether they were Republican conspiracies or religiously inspired conspiracies. There were structures in place to inform the authorities in London on what was happening in the rest of the country. And it was always the job of controlling spies throughout the realm was something that was very much the prerogative of the Secretary of State, as the position was as it existed in the early modern period. Then it kind of changed a bit, and we end up with a Home Secretary in the 19th century, and a Foreign Secretary, and other types of high ranking ministers like that. But out of these, I guess the Home Secretary retained that control over intelligence gathering and espionage and spycraft into the 19th century.
I like the way you describe it, because you highlight something that I think gets to why the British, for lack of a better word, deluded themselves into thinking that there was no political policing in Britain, because it had that association with monarchy, with tyranny, and was sort of seen as not the kind of thing that you wanted in the freedom embracing society that Britain imagined itself as being in the 19th century. And yet, as you described, it wasn't as though it was abandoned and recovered, that it was there with the French Revolution. You have a very active Secret Service movement that other historians have written about, and that it was. As you point out, it was there, but it was not systematic. It was much more secretive and irregular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. It was essentially kind of the world of the Scarlet Pimpernel, that the type of kind of swashbuckling environment of kind of gentleman spies roaming the continent, trying to save aristocrats from the guillotine. So it was very much that kind of romantic, very much not bureaucratic, not institutional type of espionage and intelligence gathering. And it sort of went on like that for a while until the later 19th century, essentially, when this period that I looked at in the book starts, a period that kind of demanded more more permanent structures, more a more serious, I guess, approach to tracking subversive action, to keeping an eye on the various movements that were emerging at the time, movements especially connected with Irish nationalism.
I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate upon that point, because you are talking about a period that is distinct, and you're talking about a challenge or maybe even a threat that didn't exist before. Why was it in the 1870s and in early 1880s that you had this decision to go from the more irregular, localized approach to the much more systematic one that is adopted by the Home Office in 1881?
I think a lot of it had to do with the increased militancy of Irish republicanism. So I talk a lot about the Fenians and Fenianism in the book, and that refers to essentially a kind of an umbrella group of various Irish nationalist organizations in the 19th century. Some were very much in favor of revolutionary action and kind of unleashing terror attacks, to put it somewhat strongly, but the idea was to take military action against the British administration in Ireland. And the problem really intensified when, in the later 19th century, many of these radicals begin contemplating taking action in Britain itself, with the purpose of kind of panicking the British government and to essentially leaving Ireland, ideally, but at least making concessions towards more autonomy and more rights for the Irish in Ireland. Because the police structures in place at the time, including the Metropolitan Police, which had been established in 1829, did not really have the apparatus, I guess, in place to deal with a significant organized radical organization. The Home Office put in place certain mechanisms to create a new police organization, which became the Irish branch, and then another structure which became the special branch later in the 1880s.
There's this aspect of your book that I found to be very enlightening, and something that is it's one of those elements that's hidden in plain sight. And it's this aspect of the history of the period that oftentimes is overlooked because it tends to be treated as episodes. And what you do is you connect them together. And I'm talking here about the bombing campaign you described, because you put that at the center of this consideration. It's the kind of thing where it's not as though this bombing campaign was secret or that it was covered up, because it was the sort of thing you couldn't cover up. But you show how the way you detail it shows how the use of explosives, the efforts to set bombs in various places, it's the kind of thing that reading it today in the early 21st century, there is definitely a level of familiarity with it that you don't always have with certain aspects of the history of the period. But the idea that there is this growing threat of terrorism, not necessarily terrorism of the population, but this idea that there's this bombing campaign that's targeting the authorities, and these bombs are going off and oftentimes injuring civilians, or sometimes they are offering more of a targeted terrorist campaign. This is on top of things like the Phoenix Park murders. And you take all this together, and you the way you present it makes it pretty clear why it is that Sir William Harcourt, the Home Secretary, makes this decision in 1881 to say, we need to start adopting a more systematic approach to this.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that he was not necessarily the natural choice to be taking an aggressive, almost kind of authoritarian line on policing. He had been a radical earlier in his youth. He had favored kind of the right of asylum for political refugees coming in from France and the continent. So he had been very much kind of on the left of the Liberal Party. But once after he was made Home Secretary, he became much more alarmed by the threat of Irish nationalism. And I think it was also a naturally kind of a panicky person prone to kind of fits, as many of the people who worked with him and knew him personally described. So that kind of influenced his decision-making, I think, quite substantially as well, because he at first wanted to make a bold, radical break with the past, which is why he established this Irish branch of Scotland Yard in 1883. And when it was clear that that wasn't necessarily working the way that he had envisioned, he almost did a 180 and attempted to kind of turn back the clock on this process of modernizing the political police and started favoring a more kind of reactive approach, meaning that that type of policing where you just sent bobbies on the beat and they're there, their presence is known, and so would-be wrongdoers are kind of intimidated by that and convinced not to do their evil deeds, which of course didn't really work, but it had an interesting kind of set of consequences for the political police in Britain, and it led to a lot of infighting and all sorts of interesting but destabilizing ultimately things.
So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about this Irish branch. What was its place in the policing structure, and who was in charge of running it, and who was being selected to staff it?
It was Section B of Scotland Yard. Section A being, of course, the regular detective branch, the Criminal Investigations Department as it existed until the early 1880s. Harcourt was essentially practically in charge of it. There was a superintendent of this special Irish branch at first, someone called Adolphus Williamson, who was briefly involved in the Jack the Ripper case, I think, as a kind of a marginal figure on the periphery. But his talent as a detective was undeniable, and so as the most senior detective, he was selected to lead the Irish branch. In terms of staffing, it was essentially Williamson, but with the authorization of Harcourt. The idea was to staff it mainly with Irishmen who were obviously loyal to Britain and to the idea of a British Ireland. But the idea was to staff it with Irishmen because it was thought that you had to have Irishmen in order for them to investigate into Irish organizations and to kind of understand the mentality of the Fenian agitators. And the staffing was not really significant at first. It was only a handful of detectives, really. Some of them were quite gifted, obviously, but it was very much a small emergency unit, so to speak.
How successful were they in going after the Fenians and arresting or driving them out of Britain?
They were not super successful ultimately, but ultimately what they were successful at was gaining intelligence from various groups that were active in Britain at the time. And they did this essentially through spies, which was the preferred method for the Home Secretary, had been since earlier in the 19th century and even before that. Spies were not too expensive to maintain, and you could just cut them loose when they ceased being useful. So they managed to gather good intelligence, but in terms of taking steps to prevent attacks from happening, that did not really come to pass because, again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the reactive model of political policing, where you just kind of respond to threats and try to take some action in response to an attack or in response to a threat, but without necessarily going to the root cause.
So you have an approach that is adopted, and it's not as successful as its envisioners hoped, and you have this ongoing problem. It would seem that all of that would suggest, and that you have, as you mentioned, even hardcore turns against it. All that would suggest this is a concept that is going to have a very limited lifespan, and yet, as you go on to describe in your book, it's actually expanded in the 1890s, mm-hmm. as the various governments identify additional threats that or perceived threats and decide that they are going to take this concept of reactive political policing and use it to address those as well. Why did they stick with the idea and what sort of threats were they now seeking to apply it against?
I think they stuck with the idea because the threats were in their view relentless. The attacks kept happening, and the early 1880s, there was a spate of bombings in London, especially, including various kind of public spaces, including, of course, the Scotland Yard headquarters itself, which was sort of humiliating for the government. So because of that, there was, and this is something that Home Secretaries, even after Harcourt, understood that you can't really turn back the time on this new kind of terrorism that was emerging in the later 19th century. And so the only solution was to try to better the political police model, to try to expand the Irish branch, try to maybe alter its methods, hire new, more qualified people. But the ship had pretty much sailed on disbanding it, which was kind of the intent. In the beginning, it was expected that once the Irish threat went away, because you know it seemed like a slight possibility for a while, then the Irish branch would be disbanded, and these people would just resume their normal detective duties. But because the threats kept multiplying, and of course in the 1890s, the organized militant anarchism becomes much more significant, especially in Europe. But because a lot of anarchists were exiled in Britain, the government felt that this was potentially a threat, maybe as important as Fenianism, and so. The special Irish branch, which had been assembled in 1887 as a kind of an experimental unit of the most senior detectives from the Irish branch, the special branch took over as the main vehicle for policing radicalism in Britain in the 1890s, and the Irish branch was allowed to kind of lapse. It became kind of absorbed by the special branch.
Now, this threat that they perceive from radicalism, anarchists, socialists, trade unionists, is a different one than the Fenians. And the Fenians have been visibly engaging in campaigns of terrorism. They've been murdering public officials. They've been trying to blow up jails and, as you mentioned, even Scotland Yard. You don't have that same type of campaign coming from a lot of people. They're not even necessarily thinking about, you know, trying to attack the state. They're rather focusing upon, say, promoting their cause or organizing workforce. Does the nature of political policing change, and how do they see their job now if it's not necessarily to try to curtail a campaign of terrorism?
I think the nature didn't really change, but the dynamics of the political police changed because in the 1880s, the Home Secretary, especially William Harker, but Home Secretaries after him as well, were very much involved actively and kind of had the reins of the political police in hand and directed what was happening. In the 1890s, the balance of power shifts a little bit in the favor of the superintendent of the special branch, which at the time was William Melville. His is an interesting life. There's been a biography written on him, which I reference in my book as well. He had risen up through the ranks, essentially, so he was not at all connected with any kind of social or political elites. He was kind of a tenant farmer's son from Ireland, and he was Catholic. So you'd think that, you know, this is someone who maybe would be sympathetic towards Irish nationalism, but his personality was very much against any kind of radicalism. He saw revolution everywhere. Everything was a threat that did not support, in his mind, the status quo and the kind of the British way of governing. And so he becomes kind of the de facto boss of the political police in the 1890s. And the methods that the special branch used were pretty much the same as in the 1880s. It was a matter of finding people that could be debriefed for the right price, occasionally finding someone to infiltrate groups. And increasingly, and this is, I guess, somewhat different from the 1880s, detectives themselves are going undercover to infiltrate groups that are perceived as dangerous. This had been attempted in the 1880s as well, the later 1880s, when Social Democratic Federation, the Socialist Party of Britain at the time, was kept under surveillance, but also some chapters were infiltrated by police detectives because they were seen as particularly dangerous. In the 1890s, that happens more and more, I think. There's a willingness to no longer just wait for something to happen, but to kind of make it happen. And I think the most telling example of that is the Walsall case of 1892, when a group of anarchists, most of whom were foreign, but they were based in the town of Walsall in England. They are arrested for supposedly having planned to manufacture a bomb and to deploy it somehow against unknown persons. It was never really specified, but the fact that they built the bomb or almost had built the bomb, that was seen as the crime in itself. And the way that the police came to learn about this incident was through the work of paid infiltrators, not police detectives in this case, just a double agent of sorts, an anarchist who actually was in the pay of the British police. But on the whole, the trend is towards more active operations rather than just kind of seeing what happens and then maybe trying to scramble for the right course of action. The 1890s is a more, aggressive decade for the political police in Britain.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's interesting because ties back to what we talked about in the book. It gets to this area that the British state had steered away from. You mentioned how in the pre-1880 period, there was a period of time where one of the earlier approaches was to, you know, prosecute people that were engaged in it, and how very quickly there rose these fears of entrapment. And early on with the Irish branch, there was seemed to be a desire to stay away from such things, such implications. But now you're starting to see the CID starting to steer back in that direction, saying, maybe we do need to catch these people in the act and in order to make our case and do our jobs.
Yeah, exactly. At the same time, I think it's important to not overstress the extent to which the special branch was looking to concoct plots or sort of create these like false flag operations. There are certain examples that point in that direction, but on the whole, it's interesting to note that a lot of intelligence was still coming from spies and even just concerned citizens, members of the public, who were sending in tips. One example is the attempted bombing in 1894 of the stock exchange. Debatable whether it was actually going to go ahead, but the police came to know that there were these couple of anarchists who were looking to have a bomb manufactured to potentially bomb the stock exchange. They came to learn about that from an anonymous tip-off, or not necessarily anonymous, but it was a tip-off from the owner of the foundry where the bomb was supposed to have been made or was going to be cast, molded. So otherwise it's doubtful that they would have known that this plot was being hatched. And so I think there's a remarkable degree of continuity with the earlier period, and that the political police is still kind of reactive. Not to the same extent, but it's still not so much interested in actively investing a lot of resources and surveilling every little thing that happens and breaking up every potential radical group. There was very much an unwillingness to deploy that many resources for the political police in Britain, unlike other countries. I think at the time, especially on the European continent, Russia was seen as the kind of the extreme end of what the political police could do if the government was fully behind it and invested a lot of resources. And so there was obviously a lot of hesitance in adopting that kind of Russian model in Britain. It was seen as extreme, as authoritarian, as tyrannical, potentially un-British, at least.
That notion of un-Britishness is one that stands out in my mind when I think back upon your book, because I thought that you describe these various groups that the special branch targets, and there seems to be this underlying, for lack of a better word, conservatism. that they're going after people who are challenging the political status quo. You have the Fenians, you have these political radicals, and then you get and you get to the early 20th century, and you're talking about foreigners who, you know, there's this related association given, you know, as you described already, the ties between, you know, presence of these foreign anarchists in England. And you also have the suffragists. And that was one that I thought was in many ways the most fascinating one, because I mean, these are not people who are the same level of threat as, say, anarchist bombers or Fenian bombers or Fenian assassins. And yet they're getting this considerable amount of attention from the special branch as though they were a similar type of threat to the status quo.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see the contrast between how the political police understood the suffragist threat as opposed to, for example, the socialist, the militant labor threat. And when it came to the suffragists, I think the government was very slow to treat it as a serious political threat. There was a lot of kind of, a very sexist attitude, really, a kind of a conception of the suffragists' demand as being no more than kind of female hysteria, and so the government did its best to ignore the suffragists, really, until it came to the wave of militancy that the most radical suffragettes unleashed in the later 1910s and up until the first day of the First World War, and it's really only in those final 2 or 3 years right before the First World War that the government is all of a sudden actually a little bit annoyed, genuinely annoyed with the suffragettes. It passes the Cat and Mouse Act of 1913, which was this act aimed at arresting the suffragettes, allowing the police to arrest the suffragettes for taking part in militant action, and then kind of releasing them and then rearresting them. And the idea was that, you know, you continue doing this until they tire themselves out. It was a very kind of, a contemptuous view of what the suffragettes were as a political threat. Whereas the socialist militants, we're definitely, I think, regarded as much more dangerous, especially in a context of the years leading up to the First World War, when there was this increased rivalry with Germany and a fear that there might be kind of a fifth column, you know, these traitors from within looking to undermine a potential British war effort should it come to that. And because a lot of socialists were also radical pacifists, the government really did not pull any punches and kind of clamping down on these activists. People like Tom Mann, as an example, I discuss in the book. He was a syndicalist agitator, a trade unionist, who was also a radical socialist, later joined the British Communist Party. And they were seen as much more threatening, I think, because even though radical socialism was not necessarily a mass movement in Britain the way that it was looking to become in on the European continent, in official circles in Whitehall, there was still fear that strikes could potentially transform into a mass political movement, a mass socialist party of sorts, and then the real trouble would start. And so the idea was to shut them up as soon as possible.
And that is something that I could see the rationale for, you know, in the argument that was made for it in terms of the challenge, you know, the disruption it poses, the how it could, you know, affect lives. And that's why I keep returning to the suffragists, because there it's about pure embarrassment. It's a fascinating one as well, because it seems whereas they're able to, have informers among the anarchists, they're able to have informers among the Fenians, they're able to get informers powers and intelligence from the militant from the socialists, as the suffragists seem to be so much of a different threat. That you describe how they it's one that they can't quite grasp a hold of in the same way. I mean, they could they don't quite get to the farcical point of, say, dressing up detectives as women and trying to get political free. There are a lot of antagonizing, but they seem to have a great deal of time trying to figure out exactly how to shut them down. It's like the notion of passing like the cat and mouse law is like, for want of a better strategy. So it's not like they can arrest them for setting off bombs, and you can maybe arrest them for disturbing the peace. But at the end of the day, the suffragists don't seem to be deterred by this, and they're trying to find a more effective way to grasp the threat or the challenge.
It was definitely challenging to infiltrate the suffragettes, because the main suffragette organization at the time, and the most radical in a sense, the WSPU, Women's Social and Political Union, led by the Pankhurst clan, Emmeline Pankhurst and her daughters, especially Christabel Pankhurst, played a very prominent role in the organization. And it was very much an organization that only accepted female members. There was, I think, one sole exception at one point, but it essentially was a kind of a closed shop for these obviously male police detectives. Other suffragette groups did allow members of both sexes, and so those were much more susceptible, I guess, to eavesdropping from detectives or spies. But the WSPU was definitely a challenge for authorities, and the only thing that they could do really was to keep raiding their headquarters and to try to harass them in any way possible. They cut their phone lines. They obviously they jailed Emmeline Pankhurst and a lot of the other leading members. And so it was just basically a war of attrition with these militant suffragettes. But also, ultimately, there was no real strategy for deterring them from taking further militant action. And I think the suffragettes caught on to that because they kept pushing the ante and coming up with more kind of outrageous acts of militancy. And it's really quite striking how close physically they got to these figures of authority, including the Prime Minister H.H. Asquith, his Home Secretary. These are people who are physically harassed, you know, in the street sometimes, but you know, Asquith, for example, was harassed on a trip that he took to Kent, I think, in 1909, to play golf and kind of forget about all the political battles in London. And the suffragists found him there and harassed him and his associates, his friends there, harassed them unrelentingly, leading to almost comical scenes of kind of, you know, pushing and shoving in places. And of course there wasn't much that they could personally do. Obviously it was not going to degenerate to the point where government ministers would be beating up suffragettes themselves. That was not an option. That would have been an absolute scandal and a disgrace. But what they could do is send in uniformed policemen, especially to break up suffragette demonstrations. And in those instances, all hell usually broke loose. And it's quite remarkable to see the egregious amount of violence that took place at these events extreme measures that the police really took to push the suffragettes back, which included very kind of aggressive tackling at times, including against, you know, elderly women. And I mean, obviously they were all unarmed and kind of just protesters. And so they were treated very violently, but at the same time, it's curious to note how close they got to actually physically harming government ministers, including the Prime Minister himself, which is something that the anarchists could have never hope to achieve, even in their wildest dreams, I think, at least in Britain.
There's a final aspect to this that you bring up near the end of your coverage of that, which is something that it's easy to lose sight of, which is that even at this point, we're now talking a generation since the Home Office under Harcourt takes the step to establish a more permanent political policing, you're still talking about an incredibly tiny organization or incredibly tiny body of men. They're able to draw upon the resources of the Metropolitan Police in order to and policing throughout the United Kingdom in order to carry out a lot of things. But you're still talking about a bare handful of people that are engaged with this. And I had to go back and think about how that may have been part of the frustration, which was that they didn't have the muscle, if shall we say, to really do this. And it also, though, points out to just how the scale shifts when you have, as the period comes to end, this growing concern about espionage. And here we're not talking about a scattered Irish organization or a handful of impoverished anarchists. We're not talking about the threat of a foreign power and deploying all those resources. The sort of foreign power that has those police agents in the practice with them, now posing a threat of a different scale. How does that change the way that the British go about this notion of high policing and sort of, not with the war, but just prior to the war?
I think right before the war, there's still a sense of, no radical change is really needed, even though this is a new threat. Germany's definitely a much more significant existential threat as compared to the vestiges of organized anarchism or kind of groupuscules of Irish nationalists active in Britain. So this was very much a serious threat, but at the same time, the special branch remained tiny, like you said. And my impression was from looking at this later period is that they were still kind of looking to shift resources from one place to another to sort of try to make ends meet somehow. It's really once the war erupts, really, that's when all the alarm bells go off, and the counterintelligence model, the military counterintelligence model, steps in and kind of makes a clean sweep of all these vestiges of 19th century sort of patchworks, and so the military intelligence aspect becomes established essentially, whereas before it had been just a matter of increase the staff of the special branch by another 10 detectives, for example, and see if it's still needed in a few years. It was that kind of mindset, which is kind of remarkable, I guess, but the authorities still did not want to attempt anything totally radical. And I think it had a lot to do with the political discourse that was in place at the time, even in this late period leading right up to the war. Britain still took pride in its liberal, I don't want to say facade, but definitely an idea of government that is not authoritarian, that does not on a massive scale spy on its citizens, that does not on a massive scale clamp down on dissent, on dissent that is just opinion and not violent dissent. But of course, the war does change things quite significantly. And even before the war, there had been efforts to move beyond the special branch and organize something at the War Office that resembled a proper counterintelligence, military intelligence organization, which is something that Britain had not really had earlier in the 19th century.
It was funny because I was reading that part, and what I was thinking of as I was reading it, and is how it. And this comes to mind again with your description, is not just how the British didn't have it, but the sense that many Britons still had that they didn't need it. And what came to mind where I made this connection was with Erskine Childress's book, The Riddle of the Sands, which is this very famous early novel about espionage, and it's about, you know, the sort of how you they would deal with the threat. And in the end, it's not there's almost this undercurrent with it in it of they don't need the type of professional organization, that two Britons can stumble across it and mm-hmm. foil it, you know, through that you don't need to have it, you know, the sort of spy networks in place that the French or the Germans or the Russians would have.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, I mean, this mentality did not really immediately die off because the First World War. I mean, I'm reminded of, for example, the life and death of Colonel Blimp, this famous wartime Second World War era movie about this British military officer who gets into all sorts of adventures and mishaps, but it's very evocative of that kind of traditional British fair play myth or self image, so to speak. That, you know, we don't use dirty methods. We're not like those tyrannical governments in Germany and France to some extent, of course, because the traditional rivalry with France. But I think ultimately, this was very much a political discourse that maybe wasn't that widespread, in the end, because a lot of people did not actually object to there being a political police of sorts, even in the 1880s, when things were still very much kind of stuck in that Victorian mindset of, you know, Britannia triumphant, freeborn Englishmen and all that. And there was still this acceptance amongst the general public that terrorist threats have to be met with the utmost force. And it goes beyond just preserving these traditional images of British liberalism when the safety of the public is at stake. Then more or less all methods are fair.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. Right now I'm working on a biography of Henri Rochefort, who was a political militant and journalist in 19th century France. He was also briefly exiled in London, along with many other people, like the anarchists that I talked about earlier. He was someone who was influential, not just as a journalist, but also as a radical left-wing politician who riled up a lot of people and had a very interesting life of constant political exile, escaping from penal colonies, duels with all sorts of people. So, yeah, it's a fun story, I think.
Sounds like it. Hopefully that when you complete it and it's published, we can have you back on the podcast to discuss it.
Absolutely. I would love that.
Vlad Solomon, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.